welcome to Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with James Kraska about his new book. He's co-author of The Free Sea, The American Fight for Freedom of Navigation. And it's an historical and somewhat legal look at freedom of navigation and how the United States has tried to protect that. James Kraska is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, and he has taught at Harvard Law School and Duke University. He's also a retired naval officer, so he definitely knows his stuff. So we discuss some of the historical events that involve freedom of navigation. We look at a little bit of World War II, compare it to things that are going on today. We look at China and that country's current attempts to restrict freedom of navigation in its region. So we talk about a whole lot of interesting issues as far as how the Navy tries to do its job to protect global security and the global freedom of navigation. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Professor James Kraska, co-author of The Free Sea, The American Fight for Freedom of Navigation. Thank you for speaking with me.
That's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let me just start by asking your history in writing and in history. Can you give me a background?
Sure. I was a Navy judge advocate, a Navy lawyer, and an officer for 20 years. And during that time, it was impressed on me the importance of operational freedom for U.S. naval forces, surface forces, submarines, and air forces to be able to transit throughout the global commons in order to accomplish their mission. And one of my last assignment on active duty was as a military professor of international law at the Naval War College. And during that time, I finished my research doctorate in law on the issue of maritime power and law of the sea and the importance of freedom of navigation. And since then, I've retired and I went to Duke University and taught and then returned as a civilian professor at the Naval War College, where I teach and now am chairman of the Stockton Center for International Law. And my colleague, Raul P. Pedroso, was also a professor here, a civilian professor here, and he's got more than 30 years of experience as a Navy judge advocate in a number of very senior positions. And so we sort of put our head together and thought about the importance of operating in the global commons and the access to the oceans, and realized that the history of the United States is really formed by these challenges to operating at sea, and that the United States you could think of as an enormous continental-sized island connected to Europe and Asia by the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. And then it's imperative, and it has been imperative from the very founding of the Republic, for the U.S. to be able to use the oceans both for commercial transit as well as for naval purposes.
Okay, so that brings me to the question about the subject matter and focus of this book. How much is it history versus law, or, you know, what is the mix?
It is a mix of history and international law and policy, and we span the entire history of the United States, we look at major milestones and how this issue of access to the global commons has been a feature of American foreign policy and, in fact, has often led to tension and even armed conflict with other states, beginning with the first war that the U.S. fought as an independent country, which is the quasi-war with France, 1798 to 1800, and going all the way through to the present with the current challenge by China to assert unlawful jurisdiction and even sovereignty over the South China Sea.
So let me ask a very basic question for listeners. What is freedom of navigation, and why should the U.S. be allowed to just sail the seas and enforce it?
Sure. So freedom of navigation is the doctrine of operating freely on the oceans, both for commercial purposes and military purposes. And it's a shortcut term, a contemporary term. It used to be called freedom of the seas. And it's the idea that the oceans cannot be owned by any particular single country, and that states may not make unilateral claims to the ocean that impinge on the rights of other countries to use this area or this global commons. And so it's much like outer space or the moon or Antarctica, in which it's an area in which no country is recognized as having sovereignty beyond certain prescribed limits. And those limits are codified in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which reflect customary international law. And so it's, as customary international law, it's binding on all states. And your second question is why the United States should champion this perspective, or why the United States needs to use the oceans? I apologize, I missed it.
Right, exactly. You know, why someone might ask, you know, why the United States? Why aren't other countries doing this? Or, you know.
Well, the United States has to, because nobody else will. And other countries, as they have in some other aspects of their security, have basically outsourced their security to the United States. And so there are states, almost all states, to which this is a very important issue, and particularly U.S. friends and allies, such as France or the United Kingdom or Australia or Canada, and they have bought into the concept as far as it goes for themselves. But first of all, they don't have the global commitments or the global reach that the United States has. And second of all, they rely on the United States to maintain order at sea. And this has been the case since the doctrine gained traction in international law in the 1500s and early 1600s, when the Dutch and then the British enforced a freedom of the seas against the southern European states, particularly Spain and Portugal, that had sought to divide the oceans between them. And the Dutch were the first states to say, and of course at the time they were involved in a war of liberation against the Spanish Empire. Mm-hmm. But they rejected this notion that some states could unilaterally assert a claim of ownership over the ocean, and that the oceans were granted through natural law by God for all countries to use. And then, of course, the British adopted this same view, and they assumed leadership from the Dutch. And then the United States, likewise, has assumed leadership in this area from Great Britain.
So at what point was the handover, so to speak, from Great Britain to the U.S.?
Well, that's arguable. Certainly it began in the 1880s with the end of with the closing of the frontier in the American West, when the United States consolidated its country, and then its gaze started to go beyond that, and it sort of got caught up in the race for colonies in the 1880s, and then by 1900 had defeated Spain in the Spanish-American War. At the time, the British, the Royal Navy, was still preeminent, and you know, so you could argue about exactly when the handover occurred, but certainly there was no doubt that by 1945 that the United States had assumed that role. I would suggest that it actually occurred even earlier. I would say by 1917 it was apparent that that Britain was quite exhausted, and that the United States was really the paramount power. Although during the 20s and 30s, the U.S. and the Royal Navy were about even as far as their force structure. But I think in terms of just economic power and and political influence and gravitas, the United States had already begun to edge out Great Britain as sort of the torchbearer for this doctrine of freedom of the seas.
During the period of time you cover, which is basically the whole history of the United States, how many incidents, how did the U.S. really enforce freedom of navigation? How many incidents went about peacefully versus how many ended up in maybe violent conflict?
Well, the number of incidents are really probably innumerable. And it was a, so the United States, Americans in particular, like to think very much, and Westerners like to think very much in terms of a bright line between peacetime and wartime. But if you look at the freedom of navigation, it's really a continual struggle for operational rights and struggle in diplomacy and international law. So it depends on what you would count as an incident. I mean, there are some, we cover in the book some of the main incidents that were violent occasions or that were particularly significant, such as, say, the Gulf of Tonkin incident or the Pueblo incident, that had great consequence for the country and for freedom of navigation. But I mean, if you look at all throughout American history, there are challenges by states making unilateral claims, exclusive claims to the oceans to try to impede American commerce or to try to turn away or to try to keep at bay American sea power. And so, you know, this is sort of almost an organic process that is continual, and it kind of ebbs and flows.
So what sort of resources does any country's Navy, and I guess primarily the U.S. since that's what we're talking about, what do they need to enforce freedom of navigation over the globe?
Well, I think like any sort of strategic equation, you have to have political will and you have to have capability. And so political will means recognizing how does a U.S. congressman or an American president sell it to a farmer in Kansas the importance of, or, you know, somebody in Oklahoma, the importance of freedom of the seas or freedom of navigation. Of course, you do that by emphasizing the American connections with other countries, and that about 90% of our trade goes by sea. It goes by sea because the oceans are far, sending material on ships is far cheaper than by aircraft. It's also, by the way, much more environmentally sustainable. And so that's the political will, is to see what to recognize what the threats are and exercise diplomacy and expend political capital in order to maintain or preserve freedom of navigation. And then capability is having a sufficient force structure, an naval and air force structure that can back up those American claims.
So would you say, at least as far as naval strategy in this regard, do you focus on protecting foreign ports, choke points, sea lanes of communication or lines of communication? You know, where do you, you know, where has the U.S. placed its forces over time?
Well, really everywhere beyond the territorial sea is important. And even territorial seas I include as part of the global commons. So the territorial sea now reaches out to 12 nautical miles generally from the coastline of a state. And states are entitled to claim sovereignty over that area in accordance with international law. We include that as part of the global commons because even though it is under the sovereignty of a coastal state, ships of all nations, including warships, have the right of innocent passage in those areas near the shore. The U.S. has focused on protecting freedom of navigation within other countries' territorial seas, by operating in innocent passage, which is allowed under the Law of the Sea Convention, And then especially in exercising high seas freedoms or virtually unrestricted freedom to operate beyond the territorial sea in exclusive economic zones, which go out to 200 miles and then on the high seas, and a navigational regime for both the high seas and the exclusive economic zone are the same for military purposes and for simple transit. The only way they differ is that in the exclusive economic zone, the coastal state has certain rights over fishing and oil and gas and other economic extractive industries and extractive purposes. And so the United States has exercised these rights through a variety of means, including operation of surveillance and reconnaissance aircraft and ships, which then can cause incidents such as North Korea seizure of the USS Pueblo. We've done so through operating military sealift command commercial vessels, such as the the SS Mayaguez that was taken by Cambodia in the Gulf of Thailand, and in overflight, using the area above the exclusive economic zone and recognizing that it is part of international airspace. And in doing so has aggravated some states such as China, which has, for example, in 2001, China sent up two F-8 fighter jet aircraft and intercepted a T-3 propeller-driven aircraft surveillance maritime reconnaissance aircraft in the United States, and the two aircraft collided and one of the Chinese fighter jets was lost as well as the pilot. And so it's these sorts of incidents where countries challenge the right of U.S. forces to operate freely in areas permitted by international law that we have focused on.
Would you say it's an expansion, or how great of an expansion from the concept of freedom of navigation is it when you include airspace, you know, patrolling of the seas from the air?
Well, it's a natural expansion. I mean, it's been about 100 years or more than 100 years since it has occurred. International airspace has always been considered to begin at the edge of the territorial sea. The territorial sea used to be 3 nautical miles, and that 3 nautical mile limit began to erode in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century as some states pushed for greater, larger territorial seas. And they did so principally based on economic reasons, but also sometimes for security reasons. But the standard gradually settled during the Law of the Sea Convention at 12 nautical miles, and so I think that's basically universally accepted and is a tenet of customary law. It's also reflected in the work of the International Civil Aviation Organization and the 1944 Moscow Treaty on Civil Aviation, that international airspace begins at the outer edge of the territorial sea.
Interesting. So over, say, the past 200 years, in regards to threats to freedom of navigation, what would you say has been the ratio, if it stayed the same or changed, between threats from non-state actors such as pirates versus states?
Well, I would suggest that the threat of piracy has greatly declined in the modern era. By the time of the 20th century, as states began to cohere into sort of more powerful economic and military so organisms or structures, that maritime pirates have been weaker. You see an occasional, you see an occasional incident. It's very telling that the greatest, in our time, the greatest threat to piracy emerged out of Somalia, which is a failed state or state that doesn't have the sort of trappings of a modern nation state, with government and with rule of law and order and security forces and a monopoly of power by the government. So by far the greatest threat to the freedom of navigation in the modern era is our nation states, our states. Now, the two back in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, before the Treaty of Paris in 1856, you might say that the two were indistinguishable because most states, including the United States, used privateers for naval purposes or to assert naval power and to interdict enemy shipping. And this occurred all through the U.S. Revolutionary War, the Napoleonic Wars, and into the era of the Crimean War. And it was only with the Treaty of Paris that most nation states accepted that they would no longer use privateers. And at that point, when these pirates were no longer operating with the sanction of the state, then they were considered enemies of all mankind. And so that significantly, dramatically undercut their business model. And so I would say that since then, the threats to freedom of navigation have come from naval forces rather than these private individuals.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed reading one advanced review of the book, someone compared China's current restrictions on freedom of navigation with what Germany was doing, I guess, before World War II began. Is that a proper comparison in any way, or can you address that?
Well, not to be sort of overdramatic about it, but I would say that China's position now is the greatest threat to freedom of navigation since we have contended with German U-boat warfare. Maybe the only exception or the only runner-up to that would have been some of the early efforts by the Soviet Union. You might recall the Black Sea bombing incident in 1988, and where the United States exercised innocent passage within Russia's Soviet Union's territorial sea. But generally, Russia has been in the same boat, so to speak, as the United States, despite having Cold War differences and not above scoring points against each other. It's ironic that the U.S. and the Soviet Union worked in tandem as major maritime powers to preserve navigational freedoms during the negotiations for the Law of the Sea Convention. And if you think about it, Russia has a greater need for navigational freedom than the United States, because all of the major Russian naval bases are zone locked behind territorial seas and the exclusive economic zones of other states. And so whether it's Murmansk or the Black Sea or the Baltic Sea or out in the west, Vladivostok, all of the major fleet concentration areas of Russia must go through very narrow straits or along the borders of the ocean borders of other countries. And so for Russia, freedom of navigation, or the ability to navigate freely in the coastal zone, is particularly important. And that's why the U.S. and Russia, combined with France and Germany and Japan, is a powerful voting bloc in the Law of the Sea negotiations. So China was, at that time, China was not particularly concerned with the issue. It was more concerned with development and resources and joined the group of 77 states, and sort of marginally sought to limit the rights of major maritime powers. And of course, the bargain was that the major maritime powers would agree to an expansion of the territorial sea of 12 nautical miles in exchange for the right of transit passage through international straits. And then the major maritime powers also agreed to creation of the exclusive economic zone, this 200-mile fishery and oil and gas zone, in exchange for preserving high seas freedoms within that zone. So in other words, if you're not fishing or you're not searching for oil and gas and other economic activities, then you basically maintained all of the high seas freedoms that you normally would. And so it was those two grand bargains that had fashioned the modern law of the sea, and Russia and the United States cooperated in doing so. But now we've seen the threat from China, as China has emerged as a major power, where they have not entirely bought into the bargain that they had made earlier, that they seek to undo it in certain ways, or at least in undo it as it applies to China, even if it doesn't apply in other countries' coastal areas.
So would you say China is temporarily trying to restrict freedom of navigation so that they can achieve certain, I guess, strategic goals as far as territorial claims? Or do you think they're trying to construct sort of a permanent regime where, you know, everyone else stays out of the waters close to them, so to speak?
I think it's the latter. They're trying to create a permanent exception to the general framework that applies to them, and that helps them to consolidate their position as the dominant power in East Asia. And the only way that they see that they can do that is to keep U.S. forces out of the first island chain, that is the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and that if they can dominate that area, which used to be under the exclusive sort of power of the U.S. 7th Fleet, but now is much less, you know, much less certain. In fact, it appears that China probably now can pretty much dominate the East China Sea and the South China Sea in a military confrontation. And that gives them strategic space or strategic depth. I think that they seek that as a permanent condition. And not only that, I think that they're trying to use not only their capability, but also they would like to advance international law that would allow them to control even out to the second island chain, that is out all the way out to Guam. And by doing so, they build strategic depth and they create a buffer that prevents the U.S. from aiding friends and allies. And they would like to decouple South Korea and Japan and Thailand and Australia and the Philippines from the United States. Because it's only American power that can challenge China.
So this might be beyond the scope of your research, but looking back at Japan's goals, you know, with World War II and their control of East Asia, were they also? Do you know if Japan was planning to control the seas in the same way? You know, if they won the war.
Well, they were. I mean, Japan sought to do the same thing, but of course, I mean, they did it through a brutal and aggressive war. So there's not, there's only so many similarities, and I don't think that China is similar. I think China has learned from lessons of the past, and maybe if they had been doing this in the same position 100 years ago, we might have seen, or 50 years, 75 years ago, we might have seen, you know, a similar sort of thing as Japan, but China is much more restrained, much more controlled, much more responsible, of course, than what Japan did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily addressing the means so much as sort of the end goal as far as what they controlled.
Yeah, I mean, I think Japan was more overt about it, and Japan sought, you know, colonies and their invasion in Korea and their invasions into China, were much more severe. I think that China has much more of an idea that these other countries would have to contend with the dominant power of China, put them in sort of a Finlandized position, like Finland was during the Cold War, in which it had to accommodate Russian interests in sort of a major way, and kind of consider Russian interests as foremost before they make major decisions. And I think that's the position that China seeks to impose on its neighbors in the nearby countries. So, you know, much less brutal and much less sort of absolute control, I think, than Japan had during World War II, but much more of a benign system of leadership in which China's interests have to be accommodated first.
It seems to me that, I don't know if this is the case, but does China consider freedom of navigation sort of a Western idea that basically restricts their ability ability to grow?
Well, as far as kind of Chinese thinkers, I don't know if I would say that. China utilizes freedom of navigation. For example, they've conducted innocent passage through the Aleutian Islands in 2015. They use freedom of navigation to conduct counter-piracy operations in the Western Indian Ocean. I think it's fair to say that China has invested in some doctrines of historical presence that they believe provide either exceptions or a different paradigm for asserting control over the oceans. And they've made claims based upon operations by their fishing fleets in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea. But those historic claims don't meet the test in international law that is widely accepted, which is in order to claim somewhere as historic waters, it has to be an area like a bay, and that the coastal state has to have controlled the area, must have done so for an extended period of time, say decades or longer, and most importantly, that other states in the region have to acquiesce or accept that assertion. So something like Canada's claim over Hudson Bay has been ongoing. The United States disagrees that Hudson Bay is an historic internal waters of Canada. We just have a friendly disagreement about that. Another example might be Chesapeake Bay. The United States claims Chesapeake Bay is an historic bay. That's probably a valid claim because it meets the test. China's claims are also much more ambiguous. So they have the nine-dash line claim throughout the South China Sea that is like nothing we've ever seen. I mean, it's not connected to the coastline. It's not a bay. And it's not really clear whether they're claiming exact sovereignty over the area or some sort of amorphous sovereign rights and jurisdiction. And so China is using ambiguity, I would believe, as a sort of as a strategic legal weapon to erode the existing framework in its favor.
Okay. So overall, you know, the book covers these historical issues and freedom of navigation, legal issues. What would you say is sort of the main issue that the book is trying to get at? You know, what is it trying to tell the reader at the end?
The main issue is that freedom of navigation or freedom of the seas is not a condition that persists unless it is cared for and promoted and championed, and that gets back to capability and will, and that when the United States has had the willpower and devised the capability to preserve its rights, then it has been successful. Sometimes in doing so raises tension and even risks armed conflict, which is always undesirable or uncomfortable to consider. And that in the contemporary era, if the United States does not continue to maintain operations in areas that are unlawfully claimed by other countries, that it will slowly begin to lose its rights, much like in international law, where if rights are not maintained, they can dissolve over time. And so the book is sort of a warning for contemporary leaders and scholars that freedom of navigation had to be fought for, that it's not necessarily a condition that will persist on its own logic.
So what resources did you use for your research?
Well, we tried to the maximum extent to use primary sources from the quasi-war with France to the Barbary Wars, a lot of documents from the U.S. government, the War of 1812, World War I, World War II. I mean, some of these are major documents that we're already familiar with, such as President Wilson's 14 points to end World War I, where he called upon all states to respect freedom of navigation in peacetime and in war. And in war, what he meant is the right of neutral states to operate freely on the oceans without interference to their neutrality. And the same occurred with the Atlantic Charter when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill met in Argentia, Canada, and decided on the war aims of the United Nations. And that was in 1941, even before the United States was party to the conflict. And the United Nations was small u, small n. It was the United Nations against fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And that group of United Nations, which at the time was only the two, plus gradually the Soviet Union joined, and by the end of the war it was 17 states. And this Atlantic Charter, one of the four planks of the Atlantic Charter, was freedom of the seas for all countries. And of course this group, this core group of United Nations, then met in San Francisco in 1945 and formed the UN that we know today. And so this story has kind of been part of the backstory of the emergence of international law and international institutions all along.
So, were, as far as the legal issues, did you pretty much write about issues that you were pretty familiar with, or did you do some extra legal research that where you came to new conclusions about the issues?
Well, we were already fairly familiar with the contemporary examples. So, for example, the freedom of navigation in the Gulf of Sidra, which, you know, you may recall was sort of an ongoing issue in the 1980s, the right of U.S. and other foreign forces to be able to operate south of the line of death. This was just a unilateral claim by Libya trying to close off the Gulf of Sidra to international shipping. The tanker war in the also in the 1980s, the Black Sea bumping incident in the 1980s, we already had some familiarity with them, and we were very familiar with the emergence of China as a threat to freedom of navigation. Both Professor Pedroso and I had operated in official positions. He at the U.S. Pacific Command and at in a special assistant role for the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and me with the Office of the Navy Judge Advocate and as a legal advisor for the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, and then for the Joint Staff. So we were familiar with the last 15 years or so of this story very much with China, and then we had some greater familiarity with the incidents you know, that predated that, the 15 years even prior. So the historical research, I think, we had an understanding of it, but went into declassified documents, CIA archives, presidential libraries, in order to, and then also some of these going back to the founding of the Republic and in the late 1700s and early 1800s have been collected in books, and so we referred to them.
So what part of the research was most enjoyable for you?
Oh, most enjoyable, I would say the farther back I learned the most, personally. So going back to the early, you know, the earliest chapters, because I had not looked, I had sort of an overall sense of the arc of history and how it was affected. And I was surprised somewhat at how important freedom, this idea of freedom of navigation was to the United States, both strategically as well as philosophically. And the founding fathers were of a mind of sort of liberal governance. And I remember George Washington said, let's be well-wishers of all and, you know, not enter into entangling alliances. And they had the idea that the United States would be this this liberal actor that treated everyone, all these other countries, equally and didn't wish any harm on any of them and just wanted to, you know, be a republic to conduct business, to conduct commercial activities, and that politics intervened. The Napoleonic Wars in particular, which lasted The French Revolutionary Wars and Napoleonic Wars lasted for a period of 30 years and dragged the United States into both the quasi-war with France and the War of 1812. And this was primarily over Europe and France both not wanting the United States to trade with the other and strengthen the other's hand on the continent, and the United States pushing for its independence and its ability to trade with whomever it sought. So I think for me that was very interesting. And then the lead up to both World War One and World War Two, again focusing on trade, this time with the United States again as a neutral power, wanting to trade with all countries and not willing to submit in that case to Germany in both World War One and World War Two. And that was that was a significant cause of U.S. entry into the war. Mm-hmm. Both wars.
What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
Oh, most surprising. Well, I already had some familiarity with the U.S. and the Soviet Union working in concert, but looking at some of the declassified documents and the history of that was quite interesting, that here were two adversaries locked in the midst of the Cold War, and yet they both agreed that the freedom of navigation ought to be the rule set, the regime that continues for 71% of the planet. So that was kind of interesting.
Were there any issues that were particularly difficult to research that maybe you still haven't found an answer for, or just took a long time to come to some conclusion?
Well, we do write in the book about some of the tactical engagements in all of these conflicts, and the fog of war had made some of them, in particular, let's say the Gulf of Tonkin incident or the Mayaguez rescue, trying to track exactly what happened, sort of very tedious, and there were inconsistent statements, and you're trying to fairly look at the evidence and make evaluations and lead the reader in a sort of a dispassionate and factual manner. And so trying to get some of those correct was probably the most difficult aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of this may not apply to the book, but was there anything you researched that sort of emotionally moved you in some way, sort of something that was very happily surprised, or I don't want to say surprising, but something that really moved you more than you might have expected?
I think the personal stories of the people that realized American interests and went through great sacrifice, and sometimes, of course, the ultimate sacrifice in order to protect the United States and its position in the globe, that's very moving. And we see it even in modern leaders. I mean, one person whom I would recognize in that regard is John D. Negroponte, Ambassador Negroponte, who about 20 years ago made a fairly impassioned speech on freedom of the seas and reminding the importance of freedom of the seas to American security, to our relationship with NATO and our friends and allies in Asia, that we rely on the seas in order to protect the United States. And so this doesn't have the play in the history books that I think it should, or that I would like for it to. And that there were these individuals along the way, beginning with the founding fathers and all the way up through, heroes like John Negroponte, who realized the gravity and the importance of freedom of navigation to American security.
Did you have any difficulties getting the book published?
No, I mean, not at all. I mean, we approached U.S. Naval Institute, and they accepted it. We didn't send it around to any other publisher. We thought Naval Institute was the right place. But you could write a book on every single one of these chapters, and even more so just on the philosophy and the history. I'm doing a piece now on just the emergence in 1979 of the Freedom of Navigation program and how it came about, and I mean you could write a book just on that.
So, What's your next big writing project?
The next big writing project. Well, I'm working on a. So I would like to do a book on the free sea from the perspective of the British and the Royal Navy. I haven't done anything yet. I am working with a Japanese scholar on a book for Oxford University Press titled Japanese Maritime Security and the Law of the Sea that traces Japan's sort of history of its relationship with the oceans and international law and maritime security.
So apart from Amazon and the Naval Institute, is there anywhere online people can find your works or your writing?
Sure. Some of my articles are on SSRN, the Social Science Research Network. All of my law journal articles are there. It's a lot of counter-piracy and Arctic Oceans policy issues. And then some of I have a book with Oxford, a book with Cambridge, and a book on piracy with Prager.
Mm-hmm. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
No, I'm not really. I mean, I appreciate it. I appreciate you drawing sort of a light on the importance of this issue. I think it's critical for American security going forward, especially as we are entering into a multipolar world where you have a growing number of states with power to project military power into the oceans, and not just China, not just Russia, but Iran, North Korea, and then relatively friendly states that are growing more powerful, Indonesia, Vietnam, Turkey. And these middle powers have much more capability relative to similarly situated countries 100 years ago or 200 years ago because of advances in technology. So remember I mentioned capability and will. Capability for coastal states to enforce unlawful measures has drastically expanded. Anti-ship cruise missiles, mobile ballistic missiles, conventional armed ballistic missiles, undersea mines, and as well as this whole autonomous revolution. And so it's going to be much more important even going forward, and the problem has become much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very kindly, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez Warscholar, on YouTube under warscholar1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.